Not like the brazen
giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs,
astride from land to land.
Here at our sea-washed
sunset gate shall stand a mighty woman with a torch,
whose flame is the imprisoned
lightning,
and her name,
Mother of Exiles.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Lydia Yuknovich, author of the new novel Thrust from Riverhead Books. Lydia is the nationally best-selling author of the novels The Book of Joan, The Small Backs of Children, and Dora, A Head Case, the memoir, The Chronology of Water, and the nonfiction book, The Misfits Manifesto. She's received two Oregon Book Awards and was a finalist for the Brooklyn Public Library Literary Prize and the Penn Center USA Creative Nonfiction Award. Her TED Talk, The Beauty of Being a Misfit, currently has over 4 million views. Thrust has been receiving rave reviews, and deservedly so. Rebecca Mackay calls the book alarmingly trenchant and a hell of a wild ride, daring, dazzling, and earth-splitting. This is a book to take in wide-eyed. Michelle Philgate in the Los Angeles Times writes, Thrust is the culmination of everything she has been writing toward, a blistering excoriation of power structures that also honors the resilience of those who fight back. And Ron Charles in the Washington Post says, Thrust is the most mind-blowing book about America I've ever inhaled. Lydia, in her own words, calls herself an artist emerged from the petri dish of Portland, Oregon, and we're fortunate to have her here. Please join us for our conversation with Lydia Yuknovich, which is already in progress. Lydia, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, I messaged you before the interview, and I promise not to gush, but I'm in awe of the new book. I wish the entire novel could be inscribed on the base of the Statue of Liberty alongside that famous poem by Emma Lazarus, which you quote in its entirety in the book. Now, the Publisher's Weekly review was glowing, called the book your best yet, and I have to agree, maybe not just the best of your own work, but in the conversation for one of the most important books I've read in recent memory. And with that, there goes my what's left of my professional demeanor. So I apologize in advance.
I'll take it. That's very moving to me. That's very moving to me.
No, it's just incredible. And I love the book. So let's get down to it. Some more professional type questions. Now, the last we talked on the radio was just before the pandemic, and that was January 2020. We're in the studio. Man, I was just floating because you were there along with Karen Russell, Kimberly King Parsons, Margaret Malone. And we were discussing the short story and the novel, and you said, I write in literary fragments, period. And sometimes those fragments find a place to resolve or a place to hold attention open. Those are short stories. And sometimes those fragments go on in my work and they turn into novels. Now, I think you've said you were working on Thrust for about the last 10 years. So how did those initial fragments coalesce into this novel?
I remember saying that, and now you know what I was talking about.
Yes.
I will also say that was a great, great day to be in the room with those astonishingly talented women and you. That was a really fun day. So I've been working on Thrust for more like about 4 years, although, you know, I was working on it when we spoke. And as you can see now, I'm more interested in the flashpoints of storytelling than I am the traditions I've inherited about developing a main character who moves across time and space and encounters obstacles and overcomes them, and cue the theme music. I love those stories too. I read them and I watch movies and TV and I get the pleasure from them, but those aren't where my narrative interests as an author or artist are. I love the challenge of thinking of all those other ways of storytelling that occur in moments or in the periphery or in liminal spaces. And so I try to conjure that on the page, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, I think it works very well in this book. Now, you mentioned stories, and one constant in your work is the power of stories. From an early story called Beauty in one of your very first collections, Liberty's Excess, there's that Liberty, the main character. Well, I shouldn't call her the main character, but one of the central characters in Thrust is Laisvė, which means Liberty in Lithuanian.
Yes.
And that was from 2000. And you wrote in that book, that story, she knew the world was filled with wonderfully abnormal stories. And you connect stories to the body, what you call corporeal writing, and you have a corporeal writing center in Portland. For example, in Thrust, one of the main characters, well, again, that main character, but Laisvė says, stories have a way of burying themselves underneath skin. And another character, Aurora Borealis, writes in a letter, I bring to the surface of the body and the psyche stories held so deeply within us that we shudder to speak them. I bring stories to life so that we might recover our own bodies. What's that connection for you? And I know you've answered this several times, but it's a very important part of your work, the connection between stories and the body.
It may be the thing I have to contribute in my, you know, my little puny, I'm just one person way. This idea that I keep insisting on amplifying, which is that everything that's ever happened to us and everyone we've ever met, we're carrying like tiny sediments or particles in our real actual bodies. And that those particles and sediments could make story arrangements and rearrangements at any moment. And that's an idea I find hopeful, especially during very dire times or chaotic or troubled times, which we're definitely in right now. This notion that we could, you know, pull forth stories that could change the stories we've been telling ourselves that have made us feel despair. This is an eternally hopeful idea to me, but I don't mean Hallmark hopeful. It would take work, you know, hard work. But yeah, you've asked me before and we've talked about it. I really do walk around believing we're story holders as beings in the world. And that I also don't think our stories are more important than the stories of than trees, than oceans, than animals. But I do think it's a feature of existence and it's quite beautiful to me.
Yeah, in fact, I re-listened to an interview you did with David Naiman on Verge when the book of short stories, your last story collection, came out. And you were saying that sometimes when you are blocked or you're sitting there trying to figure out what to write, you listen to your body. Is there a story in a part of your body or, I don't know, something that might be aching or that's calling attention to itself?
Yes, yes. In fact, that wove its way into most of the polyvocal character chorus in Thrust, you know, when I would think about the history of my hands or my grandmother's hands or someone I loved, their hands, who I lost in life, you know, the hand story of grief. And I would, you know, conjure those things and write about them and then use that material to invest into different characters all over the body, as you know, some of them a little more X-rated than others.
Yes. But there are like child laborers in the book that lose limbs in the course of their work, and they lose their lives at times too. You even mentioned the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire that happened in the early 20th century, where I think several hundred people died. Who were working there in a tenement and it caught fire and they couldn't get out.
Right, right. I have retained a focus on what we have done to children in every epoch.
Yes. And
it seems that we find new ways to torture children in every epoch. And so that time distortion in the novel too, between past and present, is trying to snap us back to the notion that we haven't stopped harming children. We just find new forms, apparently. And that story is still one of the most important human stories there is to tell.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that throughout the interview, but it gives me kind of a transition to take you back to your childhood. In that same interview when we were in the studio with those marvelous writers, you said you had auditory hallucinations as a child. You were given lithium, I think, to treat them.
Yeah. But
as an adult, Lydia, you've grown to appreciate and make use of that power. It's not an illness or anything. It can be a power, depending on how you use it. And most of your novels, you said, came from hearing. They started from hearing the characters, actually conversing with them. Freud's patient, Dora, in your book, Dora Headcase. Joan of Arc in the Book of Joan. And at that time, when you were writing the book, you said you had conversations with Mary Shelley, which you're using in your current novel. And you reference her in her book, Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus in Thrust. What attracts you to Mary Shelley and her novel, and maybe to fictional monsters in general?
I've always been attracted to the monster in film and television and novels. Even when I was a child, when the part of the story came to chasing and killing the monster, I would wail. I would cry so hard. And then as I got older, I began to develop ideas about what are monsters and what are we doing when we're chasing and killing them? And I began to understand my early concepts of othering and scapegoating. And that just made me love them more, of course, as a person who hasn't felt quite accepted or cohesive in communities. And as someone who had a mother who had a physical disability, and I would track how people treated her and looked at her and how she moved in the world. And I really think it made a profound imprint on me. As you know, my mother was born with one leg more than 6 inches shorter than the other. And so she had a severe limp her whole life and built up shoes like Frida Kahlo and, you know, things of this nature. And so I loved her body more than anything in the world, and the world projected onto her something else. So by the time I hit Frankenstein and read the book and read that a girl so young had written it as a challenge from famous men to write a ghost story, and that she had created this story of, you know, men making a creation that becomes monstrous. Man, I was primed. I was already primed. It's still my favorite book of all time. And at this point, behind me, there, I purchased from France this amazing facsimile of her handwritten pages. And sometimes I just get it out and like rub it on my face. It's just so beautiful to see.
Boy, that's amazing to find something like that.
Yeah. It's just gorgeous. I love it so much. So, I mean, the short answer is I was primed from a young age, given my own childhood, my mother, other reasons, to be in love with the monster. And then monster kind of breaks into particles to include characters who have been othered or pushed to the side or silenced or erased. And so my definition of monster opened up into a whole world.
And one thing I found in the book, probably, again, no main character, but there is a central focus on the Statue of Liberty. And it's the creation of this French sculptor, Frederick Bartholdi, who is fictionalized as a character in the book. You go, again, you mentioned you cross time, past, present, future. Yes. So we go from the creation of the statue, I think around 1885 it was built, to its sinking in a future apocalyptic world, which sounds a little bit like where we all are heading right now.
I know. I mean, can we even say the phrase a future apocalyptic world anymore? Because technically speaking, if you and I went and looked at the data and science right this second, it's kind of our now.
Yeah, I was just reading this morning about record heat waves in England.
Yeah.
Temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, France, Spain, and then, of course, ice caps melting, and maybe Miami will be underwater, New York, as in your novel.
Could be. I mean, it's kind of a nowness that's faster moving than it used to be. There's a great book called Of Time and Water about the speed with which the oceans are changing is now happening in a single lifetime rather than these mega epics. And it's not that you and I need to be reminded to be alarmed, but there are plenty of people who are not accepting the story we've made of ourselves. And, you know, my little urgent piece is to try and make narratives that at least shake somebody, maybe one or two people, to recognizing their own present tense.
Oh, definitely. I don't know if I'm off base here, but I found parallels between Bartholdi's Statue of Liberty and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein's monster. They were both creations that started off somewhat ideally, assembled from parts. You describe in the book how the statue that Bartholdi created was taken apart and shipped in parts on the ship Isere early mm-hmm. in the book, mm-hmm. and then assembled in New York by a crew of laborers. And the Statue of Liberty, I think he had more idealistic intentions than America was ready to accept.
Apparently.
Yeah, one detail you mentioned in the book was there were supposed to be chains in her hand, broken chains, which would symbolize the abolishing of slavery. And the powers that be said, no, don't show them in the hands, hide them under her her dress, her gown, so we don't offend any Southern racists.
That's right.
So it seems like both became somewhat, well, not necessarily monsters, each of them, but creations that were not taken the way their creator meant them to be taken.
Absolutely. Well, you're on to me. That's really astute reading, because you're on to me. I would go as far as to say that what became the story is monstrous, and how the story started out, or the what if, or the could have been. You know, can you imagine if the chains remained up high in her hand, and if that other statue of the Native American had been erected in a way where they kind of saw each other, and they were both, you know, the experience of coming into the harbor. This is why it's so amazing to me to think of how differently the story could have gone. And this is true of all of our histories forever. You know, there's always this moment where the beautiful is emergent, or change is emergent, or transformation is emergent. And sometimes it emerges and becomes a story, and sometimes it doesn't. And I was very interested in reminding us that we've had our own flashpoints where things could have gone much differently. And now we're stuck in a different time with flashpoints, and we have choices.
Well, it's always good to remind ourselves of the way these things started out, and maybe we're at a flashpoint where we can go one way or the other. You talked about kind of the hidden stories there, and you've described Thrust as a love letter to laborers, in particular those who worked on assembling the Statue of Liberty. You write very vividly about them, and they come to life on the page. And you write in the book, the story of workers is buried under the weight of every monument to progress or power. It's a part of history, especially U.S. history, that's rarely told, the workers themselves. But those are the stories, Lydia, that most interest you.
Yeah, there are probably personal reasons for that, and then emotional reasons and intellectual reasons. I consider being a teacher for so many years a form of being a laborer, and I think of it globally. I don't think of it just in terms of the U.S., but anyone who is a teacher right now, and also nurses and doctors and people who serve humans, I think of that as a labor that gets undertold in terms of what rises to literature. But this, one of the seeds of my love of laborers comes from having been arrested and part of my punishment for one of the times I got in trouble, one of the several times, was that I was on road crew for a while. And I was the only woman in my road crew. And the labor we did, you see it when you drive around in your car. You see people on the side of the road.
Orange vests, yeah.
Day-glow vests, exactly. Or lots of groundskeeping work, lots of janitorial work. The side labor nobody wants to look at or do to serve humanity and get your punishment when you've been bad. But what happened to us is an instantaneous bond or love of strangers. And we weren't ever going to see each other again, I was pretty sure. But it was a form of love I'd never heard of or seen before. And I think it got in my body for sure, because it changed my writing, it changed my life, and it changed who I wanted to help in the world, which is partly how Corporeal got born. I extracted myself from academia and moved my labor over to a place where different people might have access.
Now, talking about the stories, the labors, and polyphony, in the literal sense, you have a first chapter, the book's first chapter actually is called Crucis One, and there's a beautiful passage in there, and I'm not the first reader to say it sounds like something out of Walt Whitman in its cadence, its cataloging, inclusiveness. I was just going to read a part of it.
Okay.
And I hope I don't butcher the rhythm of it, because it was so important. But we were Jews and Italians and Lithuanians and Poles. We were Irish and Native American and Chinese. We were Lebanese and African and Mexican. We were Germans and Trinidadians and Scots. We were an ocean of laborers. We spoke Russian and French and Italian and English and Chinese and Irish and Yiddish, Lakota and Spanish, and a swirl of dialects, our languages, a kind of anthem. I just love the rhythm of the passage. Are readers like me and some of the other ones who've said this, were you consciously channeling Walt there?
He's in the wheelhouse for sure. Leaves of Grass had an enormously important impact on me when I read it. I think I might be one of the only people who opened Leaves of Grass, read the first page, and didn't stop. You know how people say, I read the whole book in one night. I just sat in where I lived at the time and read the whole book. I couldn't believe it. But to get back to your question, I was trying to evoke song and chorus of languages and bodies and voices, absolutely. And I was trying to kind of bring my own, you know, small version of it to life on the page, to remind us that when we love our differences, it could make song. And when we are inclusive of other languages, experiences, brutalities, and beauties, it can make song. And so that I try to be rhythmically on the page inside song or poetics, it's meant to kind of, you know, itch the reader's imagination so that you feel something in your body when you're reading it, because it still exists in us. I don't care how many times we blow it or make the wrong choices. We still have song in us, and it's our job in every epic to find it.
When we talked about Verge, again, in the KBOO Studios, the last story in that book, I think it's Two Girls.
Yeah, that's meant to be.
I mean, it reads like a song.
It's supposed to be. It's supposed to be kind of a teen lullaby. Yeah.
And I see that over and over in parts of Thrust.
Yeah.
That rhythm, I have a question a little later on what you riff on, certain objects, certain creatures.
Yeah.
They reappear, apples, snakes, axolotls, pennies. And that's almost a unifying, like in jazz, it's almost a unifying way of everything cohering.
Yep. Well, so Jazz is also one of my major influences, and not everybody knows this, but I play the clarinet and I can play the saxophone too. So though I don't centralize it and write about it and make it like I am the voice of jazz, I promise you it got into my body.
Well, I don't know if you remember this, but you and I actually met about 20 years ago in Portland. We had a mutual friend at the time, and you were heading down to San Diego State to teach. And you and I actually had a long conversation about jazz. You knew a lot more about it than I did, and our love of music. Again, there's the riffing in the book on these objects, pennies, apples, snakes, whales, turtles, axolotls. Yep. And Lysve says at one point in the book, I remember the strength of dreams and water and stories, how they move differently. Repetitions and association, images and accumulations, fragmentations and displacements. And that to me is music. It's lyricism, it's poetry. That's how they operate.
Yeah, for me too. And I think, you know, in capitalism, the market determines how one art form is much different than another. So you buy a novel differently than you buy a book of poetry or a painting or an album, what used to be albums. Some of us still love them. But in the art making process, in the labor of making art, if you're in film, you're editing filmic fragments and pieces and creating a story from the pieces. If you're a painter, you're making layers. And so whatever the image is comes a bit at a time. If you're in music, you're working, you know, in the segments and bars and, you know, clefs that are pieces of music that then create a gestalt. If you're writing a poem, you're moving in lines and stanzas. And so prose writers are also moving in artistic labor pieces and then stitching, or, you know, use your favorite metaphor about what it is we do. I think I'm trying to make brief oceans appear and then recede into their particles again. But I think all art making is this similar project of trying to make song or image or, you know, rhythm or a gestalt for a brief moment for other humans. And then we remind ourselves that beauty exists and we can keep going. But then the market comes in and divides us all up again. For me, it's all the same.
That musicality of the prose, I think, makes it so readable, even though you've talked before about some of the difficulties a reader might have in Thrust, because they're expecting something that's not there.
You know, well, that's true.
Some plot points are dropped, characters appear and reappear. So it's not certainly a chronological narrative by any means, and that was not your aim. But the difficulty, I think, is totally alleviated by the attraction of reading it. Whether it's out loud or to yourself, that musicality.
That is so important to me. I feel so happy you just said that. That was the intent, that it's not like I didn't know if I subtracted effort in terms of plot and development and resolution in a linear way that people are used to. It's not like I didn't know that would be tricky. And so you're right. It's beautiful to hear that the experience of reading might be more like listening to a song or reading a poem, because it moves by association and rhythm and repetition and sound and image. And that's not new. I didn't invent that, but I'm trying to suggest a novel could move that way too.
Oh, it works beautifully for me. So you have some coherence there through the musicality, and that takes you through anything that a reader might find a little difficult or off-putting. That's not something what they expect.
Yeah.
And Lydia, in addition to the music, I found there was a fairy tale aspect to the book. Talking turtles and whales, children lost and found, brothers and sisters separated and then reunited. Not a Disney fairy tale, more from the Brothers Grimm. That doesn't...
Well, worse. Lithuanian fairy tales are even worse. They're like crazy violent.
Now, a few years ago, I talked with a writer out of Ashland, Todd Davies. She wrote a fantasy novel called Report to Megalopolis. The subtitle, coincidentally enough, is called The Postmodern Prometheus.
It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, she described the book as a fairy tale and told me that fairy tales are not escapist stories meant to transport us to another world or take us out of reality. She said, and I quote from her, fairy tales talk about who we really are. They're really true and they're important. I would imagine they're important to you here. I mean, some people might call it magical realism, but to me, it was straight out of fairy tales, of the feel of the book.
Yeah. Several people have asked me about magic realism, and I think magic realism is an incredible narrative tradition, and I'm sure it's influenced me in many things I've written and just life in general. But more to your point, I was asking, what if our reality had, you know, images and languages and rhythms we could track right now with how alienated we feel, how fragmented and divided we are, how certain catastrophes are pressing in on us, how we're looking at the possible fragmentation and dispersal of things we used to think held us together. And so I didn't feel like I was creating some kind of fantasy. I felt like I was trying to be precise on, like, what would that look like on the page? And that opened up for me, what if folktales and fairy tales are in constant need of change and revolution too? And so in that way, maybe it's a modern fairy tale for our present time. But you're right, I did not intend to lift off into fantasy at all. And I really do talk to plants and animals. So even that part, it's like meant to be kind of, you know, precise and accurate.
And like a fairy tale, there's children in danger and then they have to save themselves. You did a recent interview in Shondaland, I think an online journal. You were asked, what's one thing you want readers to take away from the book? You replied, the story isn't the story of a lone savior or a hero. It's polyphonic, and these children have to save themselves. Nobody is a rescuer of these children and young adults. That's a fact of the world we've made, and I don't get to say that out loud enough. And to me, that seems like the classic fairy tale. I'm thinking Hansel and Gretel. They had to figure it out for themselves. They had no adults helping them. You know, they would have ended up in the witch's oven and eaten.
Right. In some versions, in some cultures, they do.
Maybe in Lithuanian fairy tales?
not that I know of, but maybe. I'm telling you, Ken, they're so violent, some of them.
Well, there's a lot of that in the Brothers Grimm, too. The Disneyfication of fairy tales took all that stuff out.
Exactly. And I've been asked before why. I got asked this in Small Backs of Children too, why I make these violent, terrible things happen to children. I'm like, I don't, you know, I'm painting with the materials of my present tense. And this is what we do to children. And to make a Disney version of that strikes me as the more violent thing to do, is what I would say about that. But also, you're right, the oldest stories we have are about how children have to save themselves. And I think there's more to think about there, and more to ask about what, you know, what astonishingly beautiful adaptation powers and evolution powers exist already in children and teens and young adults. And what it is we're doing to them by repressing and oppressing and containing that astonishing imagination ability. And so some of the characters in Thrust have had that containment come in on them, like the character of Mikhail. And I made it a pulse of him that like opens back up. So his terrible crime or mistake is revealed to have been a misperception. And something else emerges. I'm kind of obsessed with that motif, aren't I? I keep writing about it.
Yes. Well, you have a novel called The Small Backs of Children. And then the children in this book, boy, a lot of them are mistreated. Some are missing limbs. And they really have to save themselves.
Yes. Well, this is the world we've made. I'll say it again. And we really need to quit pearl clutching and gasping when bad things happen to children, considering this is what we've constructed and the conditions of their lives. They didn't make that. We did.
Yeah. And you have a character in the book, Lydia, later in the book that writes, "Nothing is more important than giving children stories they can grab onto and live by. Stories about gender, race, class, pride, stories that inspire children, that show them where they came from." And I was wondering, I know you have a son, Miles, who I think is on his fourth year of college, third year?
He'll be a senior next year.
Oh, man, how exciting.
I mean, this coming year. It is very exciting. It's also terrifying. What happened, Ken?
I know. Well, I have two kids that are in their 30s, so I could tell you some of the things that happened after them, but they're always with us. I mean, it's very different. As a parent, I remember, Lydia, there were some days where I just said, can I have 5 minutes to myself? You know, I couldn't even go to the bathroom. I remember we were out somewhere, and I was at the urinal, and my youngest son, Andrew, was like running out the door, and I didn't know what to do.
That's it. You're in motion for
right. Yeah, and now I kind of miss those days, and those days I couldn't wait for them to end. So it's, but I wonder, what were the stories you were telling your son when he was growing up? It's so important, these stories. I guess when we were kids, the stories we learn, the stories we're told, maybe these fairy tales, maybe Grimm's fairy tales, they're so important to us. And you, as a writer who was so cognizant of this, I was wondering, what were the stories you were telling Miles?
Well, we'd sort of wait for him to be interested in something, or something would catch his attention. And then we would move toward like bringing that to life or giving it storytelling world. So early on, he liked to draw, we noticed. And so we brought the art world in to him when he was like three or four, just so it would be around him. And we told him stories about artists who were amazing. And he then moved toward TV and film, but not in the sort of classic Disney way. One of his favorite videos was an old video I had that I used for teaching, which was Maya Deren short experimental films. And he'd sit like 2 inches away from the TV. I know, I was a disgrace as a mother. He'd sit like really close to the TV watching these Maya Deren shorts, mesmerized. And he was like three. And he had two or three, and he had diapers and a black turtleneck on, and he's watching it. And, you know, it's just surrealism in black and white. And he thought that was amazing. So the way storytelling and folktales came into Miles' life happened partly just what he was interested in. And then his mother's a writer and his father's a filmmaker and cellist and writer. So like art became the folktale space. And we just, other cultures, other people, storytelling itself became part of his childhood. Not so much, tonight I'm going to read you this. it just became the fabric of his life. And so he majored in art tech, what's called art tech now. I think it used to be called graphic art or something.
Now, Lydia, you have a character in Thrust, Lily Yuknovicius, which sounds a lot like your surname, Yuknovich. And you've written about, and we talked about in our last interview, in fact, you lost a daughter named Lily at childbirth. Mm-hmm. And in that conversation we had, you said that Lily's death is, quote, probably the origin point for all my writings, which means her death was generative of everything. Yeah. And in the novel, you have a character, Aurora, who we mentioned, talk about Mary Shelley in her book, Frankenstein. The quote is, "For isn't the author writing herself as well? Creating a new creation story to combat her grief, did not her offspring die at the moment of birth or prematurely? Child loss induces a grief in a woman that is never overcome. A hole inside a woman is a monumental thing too." Do you see this book and maybe all your fiction as a creation story to combat your grief?
I definitely think that's one way to talk about it, for sure. I've talked about it that way. It feels true to me. It feels literally true, like not symbolically true, but I went through a kind of crucible when I passed through that grief, which lasted at least a decade in its acute form. And writing was the next thing that came out of me. And so it feels literally true. Now that there's some distance on the actual grief and trauma and loss, it feels like it's changing forms a little bit. And so it's not that I think the origin story, well, maybe it is that I think the origin story itself shifts and moves and becomes something else. And that feels like that's happening to me right now, but I don't have a great way to talk about it because I'm, you know, no one showed me how to do menopause, Ken. So I'm making it up, and it's not pretty, but I'm, you know, like it's like, I'm the thing that's changing form again. You know, like when women are pregnant, that for sure happens, or when I was an athlete and then I wasn't. So I've undergone metamorphosis before, but this is formidable. I'm not going to lie to you. And so it's like, again, shifting sediments and forms, and more of my visual art is coming out than in my past.
And a lot of your writing, and I guess your visual art too, is still in honor of of the daughter you lost.
Oh, yeah, it is.
We talked about that.
And then this novel, not for the first time, but for the first aggressive time, a young man emerged. And Mikhail is nothing like my son, Miles, except that he's brilliant creatively. Of course, I would think. but this, like,
yeah, a little tougher upbringing than Miles.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But like this younger male creature, I'm positive has to do with the generative force of having a son.
Now, Liddy, before we close, I'd like to talk about another important part of you besides that of writer, mother of Miles, and teacher. You're also a great inspiration to artists everywhere, both here in town, especially in Portland. In fact, I think I mentioned in the interview we did January 2020, David Naiman, our mutual friend and my radio colleague, calls you Portland's literary fairy godmother. and you have friends like this and people you support all over the world. And your advice, which you repeat like a mantra, is make art in the face of, well, you know what, I can't, something we can't say on the radio. But given the dire situation we find ourselves in with war raging in the U.S. Against women and the marginalized LGBTQ, the environment, our democracy itself, what do you see now as the role of the artist in America? And I don't mean to put it all on you, as Lydia will save us through her art.
No, I can't, which we all know. And it's not even the question. The question is, if art is a kind of electrical current or ocean wave or metaphor that makes sense to whoever's listening, then we're responsible as individuals to keep it in motion. And so we can take turns doing that, and nobody can do the whole thing by themselves. We can take turns doing that. So the vibrancy and the energy and the motion of us making art, you know, speaking truth to power in the old 70s mantra way, or 80s, 90s, you know, if we keep the energy in motion, then the oppressions and repressions stand less of a chance. And the sort of flashing up or interruptive or agitation power of art making can stay alive. But if we all get too much despair and quit, it's easier to flatten us out like a pancake. And then there's almost no language left that can, you know, shout back. So this is why it seems urgent and necessary and vital to me to keep the making of art in its revolutionary forms alive and in motion. Because it might not save us on a particular day at a particular time, but if we lay it down, we have no chance whatsoever. And, you know, What else are artists going to do? This is all we know how to do.
Well, there's that, but I mean, it's so important. It's not, well, I guess a certain art can be escapist, but I recently came across a quote from Iris Murdoch, and she said, "Tyrants always fear art because tyrants want to mystify while art tends to clarify."
Precisely. And so if we keep it alive in that polyphonic way, that's another idea I'm trying to amplify, that we need many of us, not one of us. We need many of us. And we don't even need the famous author anymore. We need more of us to make song rope. Get it?
Well, Lydia, it's just a pleasure talking to you. Again, I can just gush forever on how much I enjoy the book and how important I think it is, really. And I hope other readers get that. Well, I've been reading reviews, and a lot of them are really glowing reviews. I think people are recognizing the importance of this work. I want to tell listeners that maybe because of the musicality and certain things you do with the motifs throughout there, not necessarily the traditional plot or characters, it's, I hate to use the word entertaining, but it keeps you reading. For a serious book that has a serious message in here, or serious messages about our humanity, about where we're going and where we could be going. So I can't recommend it enough. I just want to thank you for talking with me today and for the wonderful new book.
Oh, good God. The pleasure is entirely mine. I love talking to you anywhere, anytime. And I actually really appreciate what you just said about the page turner quality. I actually worked hard on that.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you can listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Lydia Yuknovich, author of the new novel Thrust from Riverhead Books. You can find out more about Lydia, her work, her classes, and all her upcoming events online at lydiayuknovich.com. Just a note that KABU is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, August 11th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relations, saying,
"Are you suggesting the work belongs to Mr. Shelley? It is my story."